Hello and welcome to another episode of Opposition Cast from the Centre for Opposition Studies. I'm Nigel Fletcher. Well, there's been a lot going on in politics since we were last with you. Here in the UK, the Conservative government is continuing to encounter new difficulties. Their controversial former deputy chairman, Lee Anderson, defected to Reform UK on Monday, and much of the rest of this week has been dominated by a growing outrage about racist and misogynistic comments made by their biggest donor, Frank Hester, about the Hackney South MP Diane Abbott. There have been calls for the party to hand back the £10 million donation that he's previously given them, and new reports suggest that he's since in the process of giving them a further £5 million. All of that makes the budget seem almost like a distant memory, although it was only 9 days ago. A week really is a long time in politics these days. We had a widely trailed further cut in national insurance, but no major rabbit out of the hat from the Chancellor. And the Labour leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, used his opportunity of the traditional response to the Chancellor to mount a concerted attack on the Conservatives' economic record, with some of the inevitable rather laboured jokes thrown in as well.
Recession. The national credit card maxed out, and despite the measures today, the highest tax burden for 70 years. The first parliament since records began to see living standards fall, confirmed by this budget today. That is their record. It is still their record. Give with one hand and take even more with the other. And nothing they do between now and the election will change that. I mean, over 14 years, we've seen our fair share of delusion from the party opposite. A Prime Minister who thinks the cost of living crisis is starting to ease. An Education Secretary who thinks concrete crumbling on our children deserves her gratitude. A former Prime Minister who still believes crashing the pound was the right path for Britain.
Where is she?
And today, a new entry in this hall of infamy, the Chancellor, who breezes into this chamber in a recession and tells the working people of this country that everything's on track. Crisis? What crisis? Or, as the captain of the Titanic and the former Prime Minister herself might have said, iceberg, what iceberg? Smiling as the ship goes down, the Chuckle Brothers of decline, dreaming of Santa Monica, or maybe just a quiet life in Surrey, not having to self-fund his election. Whilst the crew behind him scrabble for TV news. If only it weren't so serious, because, Madam Deputy Speaker, the story of this Parliament is devastatingly simple. A Conservative Party stubbornly clinging to the failed ideas of the past, completely unable to generate the growth working people need, and forced by that failure to ask them to pay more and more for less and less.
Keir Starmer there, road testing some of the attack lines that I'm sure we can expect to hear him repeating in the run-up to the election. And there was some speculation that the budget might be used as a springboard for an earlier general election than we might otherwise have been anticipating, although that seems to have faded away rather, and the Prime Minister last night used an interview to rule out a May election. Meanwhile, on the other side of the Atlantic, the President of the United States, Joe Biden, delivered his last State of the Union address before their elections in November. At least we've got some certainty on the timing of those elections. It was quite a fiery speech, with much of it directed at attacking his Republican opponent, the former President Donald Trump, over his views on Ukraine and the attack on the US Capitol in January 2021.
Now my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, "Do whatever the hell you want." That's a quote. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable. We will not bow down. I will not bow down. My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win. I know it may not look like it, but I've been around a while. When you get to be my age, certain things become clearer than ever. I know the American story. Again and again, I've seen the contest between competing forces and the battle for the soul of our nation. My lifetime has taught me to embrace freedom and democracy, a future based on core values that have defined America: honesty, decency, dignity, equality, to respect everyone. Now, other people my age see it differently. The American story of resentment, revenge, and retribution, that's not me. Many of you in this chamber and my predecessor are promising to pass a national ban on reproductive freedom. My God, what freedom else would you take away? Those bragging about overturning Roe v. Wade have no clue about the power of women. But they found out when reproductive freedom was on the ballot. We won in 2022 and 2020, and we'll win again in 2024. It's because of you America's coming back. It's because of you our future is brighter. It's because of you that tonight we can proudly say the state of our union is strong and getting stronger.
And as for Donald Trump himself, his response to the speech was typically understated.
Joe Biden is on the run from his record and lying like crazy to try and escape accountability for the horrific devastation he and his party have created, all the while they continue the very policies that are causing this horror show to go. We cannot take it any longer as a country.
Donald Trump there, talking about this horror show. Not entirely sure whether he meant himself there or not, but he's almost certain to be the Republican candidate, having seen off all of his possible rivals for the nomination. The last one standing, Nikki Haley, suspended her campaign just before the State of the Union, and in her concession speech, notably stopped short of actually endorsing Donald Trump. Here's what she had to say.
I said I wanted Americans to have their voices heard. I have done that. I have no regrets. And although I will no longer be a candidate, I will not stop using my voice for the things I believe in. Our national debt will eventually crush our economy. A smaller federal government is not only necessary for our freedom, it is necessary for our survival. The road to socialism is the road to ruin for America. Our Congress is dysfunctional and only getting worse. It is filled with followers, not leaders. Term limits for Washington politicians are needed now more than ever. Our world is on fire because of America's retreat. Standing by our allies in Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan is a moral imperative. But it's also more than that. If we retreat further, there will be more war, not less. As important, while we stand strong for the cause of freedom, we must bind together as Americans. We must turn away from the darkness of hatred and division. I will continue to promote all those values, as is the right of every American. I sought the honor of being your president. But in our great country, being a private citizen is privilege enough in itself. And that's a privilege I very much look forward to enjoying. In all likelihood, Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee when our party convention meets in July. I congratulate him and wish him well. I wish anyone well who would be America's president. Our country is too precious to let our differences divide us. I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, never just follow the crowd. always make up your own mind. It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that. At its best, politics is about bringing people into your cause, not turning them away. And our conservative cause badly needs more people. This is now his time for choosing.
Nikki Haley there, suggesting that Donald Trump might not be able to count on her vote, and that's led to some speculation that she might perhaps mount a third party campaign in November, which will certainly shake things up a bit. Otherwise, it seems the battle lines have been drawn for a rematch between the current and the former presidents, who will be 81 and 78 years old, respectively, at the time of the vote, an issue that has increasingly come to be discussed, particularly in the case of the president himself. Current opinion polls show Trump having a narrow lead over Joe Biden, and the State of the Union speech doesn't seem to have moved the dial very much in the president's favour. But at this stage, the election does still appear too close to call. But returning our focus to the UK, we see rather a different picture emerging. The latest opinion poll tracker here gave Labour a 20-point lead over the Conservatives, and the budget certainly hasn't transformed the political landscape either. And it seems harder and harder to imagine if anything could do so between now and November, or whenever it is the election ends up being held. But how should we interpret those polling numbers, and what lies behind them and the trends that they're showing us? Well, I'm delighted to have as my guest today someone who could hardly be more qualified to answer those questions. She is friend of the podcast, Professor Jane Green of Nuffield College, Oxford, the co-director of the British Election Study, and as of last month, the new president of the British Polling Council. We last caught up with Jane back in autumn of 2022 during the brief premiership of Liz Truss and in the aftermath of the so-called mini-budget, when the Conservative poll rating fell off a cliff, and they've struggled to recover ever since under Rishi Sunak. So I began our conversation by looking back at that major fiscal event. How significant is it that we saw that huge turnaround in the polls at that time with the mini budget being a political moment? Mm-hmm. How significant was that moment and Liz Truss's premiership in sort of having an unmovable effect on the polls and where we are now?
It's such a great question, Nigel, because what politicians and journalists will undoubtedly focus on is leaders now, because obviously there are questions over whether the Conservative MPs are happy with Rishi Sunak's leadership and the policy offerings and all of the smaller things, you know, that, I mean, they're not small to everybody, and, you know, but they're not inconsequential. But we will be focusing on, up from now until the actual general election, on things that aren't going to have as much effect as that mini budget looks like it did in the opinion polls. And, you know, Liz Truss herself has said, you know, has made claims about what drives election outcomes and tried to, you know, push very hard against her period of government as having anything to do with it. And in actual fact, what happened at the time of the Truss mini budget is a fundamental shift. So we saw a decline in support for the Conservative Party. It dipped very, very suddenly. And, you know, there's no mistaking the timing around the mini budget. I mean, even if you drill down, YouGov had some data, a nice long time series, but really, really frequent polls. And with those really, really high frequency polls, you can see when the change happened. So there was an undoubted change in support for the Conservative Party at that moment. I think the other thing that happened that's also hugely significant is the Conservative Party, up until that point, was still the most trusted party on the economy. That changed, and now the Labour Party is the most trusted party on the economy. That's switched. And the size of the gap now between Labour and the Conservatives is fluctuating. But it's the transition. It's the fact that more people now will say, no, I don't trust the Conservatives on the economy. And you have to see over a really long time period just how significant that is. So you stretch the time period out now, and then you can do that with Ipsos polling data and take us all the way back to the beginning of the 1990s. You see another switch. So that was the switch where the Conservative Party had also lost their reputation on the economy, which was coincided with the exchange rate mechanism crisis known as Black Wednesday. You know, this hugely significant moment. And the reason these moments matter is because everybody notices them. You know, a lot of people aren't paying attention to the smaller things. They're not paying attention to the news. They're not paying attention to, you know, they might hear Rishi Sunak, oh, is he going to go, oh my gosh, you know, another leadership election. But they're not, you know, they're not focused on it in the same way. ERM crisis happens and the Conservatives lose their reputation on the economy. And that just, it sticks for ages. And it sticks for ages because these moments don't come often, very often. You know, these kind of massively salient, high recognition events just don't happen very often. And then the Conservative Party is no longer the trusted party on the economy. And we have a Labour government. And then, of course, we have the Blair years and the Brown years. And then you have the global financial crisis. And then Labour loses its reputation on the economy. And the Conservatives were ahead. And this Truss mini budget moment is in the same category as those once in a 10 or more year event where public opinion really radically changes. And I think that's hugely significant, especially in a cost of living crisis, especially when the economy is the number one issue for voters or for everybody, not just voters. And it also coincided with the start of the cost of living crisis, actually. So when you look back at when inflation started to increase, it was at the same time. And that it's really difficult to disentangle those things. I don't know, you know, if there's a I don't know, you know, if there's a really good way of doing that, of kind of understanding to what degree people have kind of thought about those events as coincidental and that Liz Truss might be driving all this inflation. You know, I just don't think that we've got any data that we can answer that question with. But it's undoubtedly a sort of potential double whammy for the Conservative Party around that time. So, you know, so this is one of the fundamentals going into the election. It's not the only one. I think Partygate also is another moment where you can see support for the Conservative Party decline. And that's not just about parties. It's also, you know, the whole kind of divisions in the Tory party, probably. And then COVID itself was important. So it's not like the Conservative Party were riding high, Liz Truss comes along and boom, you know, we've now got this kind of flatlining situation. Conservative support was declining over time, bumpy with the vaccine rollout and a bit of support at that point in time, but it was declining. But then there's this huge sharp discontinuity, and not very much has changed since, but some interesting things have been changing over the last 6 months as well.
It's interesting to make that comparison with Black Wednesday, because it does seem, as you say, to be sort of in that same category of a moment that support just falls off a cliff edge and then doesn't recover. But there is one significant difference between both that and the global financial crisis in terms of the lead up to the election, which is that in both those cases, the prime minister who was in office when that happened was the one who then fought the next election. So John Major, you know, saw that the Conservative Party's support collapse and then went into the 97 election. Gordon Brown then after the global financial crisis. But Liz Truss was removed by the Conservative Party. We had a new leader, and Rishi Sunak came in hoping that the change of leadership was going to lead to a bump in the polls. And we saw that perhaps to some modest extent, sort of just looking at the graph now. I mean, the cliff edge is quite dramatic. But then it does sort of slightly recover. Labour support then sort of goes down a bit. But one of the significant things that's happened in the last week or two that people have noticed, and certainly the Conservative Parliamentary Party have noticed, is that Conservative support has continued to decline back to the levels that it was when Liz Truss was Prime Minister. So, I mean, how unusual is it that the change of leadership seems to have not been one of those moments that changed the political weather?
So I think there are two things that are interesting about this. One is, you know, we can easily overstate just how much leader evaluations and leaders drive the vote, as opposed to people's decisions about a political party also driving the vote, but also driving how they see leaders. So, you know, we've had Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, and Rishi Sunak. When people think about the Conservative Party and Conservative government, you know, do they really differentiate Rishi Sunak when they think about, look, it's still the Conservatives. It's been Conservative government having all kinds of difficulties. They're just different difficulties, right? Mm. Like, so scandals and, you know, performance shocks and, you know, very, very controversial periods of leadership. So I think that's the first thing to say. And so much commentary is that leaders are just the defining thing for how you vote. And actually that's, you know, I think leaders are quite important sometimes for some voters. I think Boris Johnson was important for Brexit Party voters, voters on the right. I don't think that Boris Johnson was the defining factor in the 2019 election. I think it was getting Brexit done and what he stood for and the fact that he represented the side of Leave and all the rest of it. So we can really overstate that stuff, I think, is the first thing to say. And that is real warning, isn't it, to anyone that thinks a change of leadership is going to be the salvation of a party. And I think the people who think that probably put a little bit too much on the Boris Johnson effect. Mm. And there's so much else going on in that election. Your question about historical precedents is quite tricky. We did, Will Jennings and I wrote a book some years ago, and we were interested in these sort of costs of ruling. So when you come into power, you tend to have a honeymoon, your support tends to decline over time. And we argued that this was to do with like negative things mattering more than positive things. They sort of accumulate. So we attend to negative information, partly because that's what's given to us in news and in politics. But there are a few moments where you didn't see this very clear downward trend. One was the period with Margaret Thatcher and the Falklands War, that period where the Conservatives, she came in, became Conservative leader and actually increased the Conservative support. Very rare that turns around. There's obviously the coalition government period, and there you know 2010 to 2015 the Conservative vote share doesn't increase substantially because you have a load of other parties eating away at the two major parties vote, but the Lib Dems take the hit there on the kind of cost of ruling. There was also the periods in Germany where Angela Merkel had kind of refreshed the brand for her party, the CDU in Germany. But it's very rare. Mm. It's very rare that anyone manages to reverse that decline. And so, you know, I think if a change of leader matters, it probably matters because they change the party and they change the party's direction and what it stands for. But just changing the leader on its own, I don't think it's going to shift the dial.
Mm. And one thing that traditionally would be thought to do so would be a fairly dramatic change in the economy. You talk about the economy being sort of the number one issue for sort of for voters. If we look at that being one of the sort of key factors, there's not an awful lot of time left, whatever the election is, for that to take place. It was perhaps the thinking behind the mini budget in the first place for Liz Truss. You know, she was setting out an argument that the party needed to fundamentally change economic growth in order to improve its position. The Conservatives are running out of time to do that, but it was one of the reasons why the budget was perhaps seen as mm-hmm. being one of those potentially big moments. Mm-hmm. But it almost seems that if we look at the evidence from 1992 to 97, that actually, even when you had a situation there where the economy was doing pretty well by the time of the 1997 general election, it didn't move the dial. So is that another one of these, along with the leadership question, another one of those sort of straws that are being grasped by Conservative MPs that, you know, perhaps if they leave it and go long, there might be time for the economy to turn around and that will have a transformative effect. Is that perhaps unrealistic as well?
Great questions. So 92 to 97, we don't know the counterfactual, right? So we don't know if the economy had been doing worse, you know, would the Conservative Party have been even worse off than the Labour landslide in 97? I think there's loads of aspects to this that matter. I think one of them is, you know, it's kind of what you're changing with the economy. Are you changing a proportion of the electorate who feel slightly better off? And are those people going to vote for you because of that? And are they going to give you the credit for it? And are they going to feel that in a substantial way? And I think one of the difficulties with the budget statement that that Jeremy Hunt made was that people are becoming worse off at the same time as they're getting this, you know. So it is making things slightly better, right? If you have a bit more money in your pay packets or in your bank account each month, obviously from your salary, that's fantastic. But if it's also going out at higher rates, then you're not going to feel, wildly better off. You're not going to think, oh, gosh, you know, now I'm really, really enjoying life. You know, it's not going to make such a big difference. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is there a feel-good factor in the country? Do we start to feel optimistic about the direction of the country? You know, and that is very different, right? Like, is there a recovery? Are we in a boom? That's not going to happen by the next election. I think the other question is, you know, do people then say, oh, okay, now I trust the Conservatives? I don't think that's going to change substantially. And then the other thing is, can Rishi Sunak say he's met his pledges? And, you know, three of those pledges are about the economy, right? Like halving inflation, growing the economy. I forget what the other one was. And then obviously stop the boats and cutting NHS waiting lists. So can he put that package together and say, look, this was our decisions that did these things. And, you know, we promised and we delivered. And, you know, you can trust us to deliver on these things that we're promising now. So there's a lot, you know, there's a lot that has to change for these things to be important. And it's unlikely, isn't it, that there's going to be a substantial change. And the problem is as well, they're going against the tide now. So they're rowing in one direction and trying to increase their support. You've got Reform starting to eat away on the one side. And you've also got generational replacement. You've got part of these voters who voted Conservative are no longer with us. And, you know, people are pointing to this because of this huge age effect and vote choice. This generational replacement becomes actually very important. So they're going to lose voters anyway over time. So they're kind of rowing against the tide, I think.
And sticking with that metaphor on rowing against the tide, you mentioned the other pledge that Rishi Sunak has on stopping the boats with the illegal migration issue. It's perhaps been slightly puzzling to some people the extent to which the Conservatives have really sort of maxed out on that issue and on Rwanda as being this sort of one priority that they need to deliver in order to transform their standing. I just wonder, you know, that is obviously based on an idea that the type of voters that they need to secure or to win back are moved by that issue. Is that borne out in terms of the issue salience with the voters that they need to improve their position?
So it's only true that voters who are currently voting or saying they're going to vote for Reform UK care more about immigration. It's certainly true that those kind of people who are switching Conservative to Reform UK are doing so more on the basis of immigration. But those are losses, not gains. And, you know, I think the tricky thing it was true that people who were voting or intending to vote for the Tories cared more about immigration than other voters. And that was a sort of, that was a very interesting change, really, because it used to be the case that if salience dropped, it sort of dropped for everybody and you didn't see these big partisan differences. Now, what's obviously changed too since 2016 is the Conservative electoral coalition is very leavy, right? It's smaller, but it's still very leavy. And as a result of that, that smaller group that now supports the Conservative Party, even after the Truss mini budget and everything else that's taken place, and who still, you know, would vote to stay out of the EU in another referendum, that also has dropped over time. So that's a smaller group too. So immigration seems to be more important to that group. Now, the risk, however, is what you're doing there is raising the salience of an issue that people are angry about, that you're not delivering on, you're not meeting your pledges. And this is essentially creating conditions for a party like Reform UK to do better. And it's kind of curious because, you know, I was looking at this actually just today. We're working on a little piece of analysis to sort of understand Reform UK in the context of the Brexit Party and the context of UKIP. And if we look back to when UKIP were riding high, immigration plus EU, those two concerns together were pretty, you know, you'd add those two up and you'd get quite a lot of people who cared about those issues, particularly immigration. And then you get Europe, of course, Brexit being hugely significant. And that's when the Brexit Party does really well. Overall, for the wider electorate, those two issues aren't of major concern right now. So what you're also doing is alienating people who really want you to talk about public services and the economy. So it's a super risky strategy because essentially you're not talking about the things that you need to talk about and you need to resolve and deal with if you want to hold on to voters or to gain votes from the Labour Party, and you're raising the salience of an issue that's driving people to reform UK. And actually, if you hadn't done that, those issues weren't particularly salient, really, not overall. And I think they've made them more so by making it their primary focus. So, you know, we haven't seen so much of this recently. And I think as Reform UK have started to sort of creep up in the polls, I think that lesson's probably been, I think it's probably landed in number 10, to be honest. But we'll see.
Perhaps that's landed a little late, though. I mean, given that the issue, as you say, has been raised significantly. You talked about Reform UK. I just want to sort of dig into things. You've been doing some work on it today, as you say. It's probably fresh in your mind. But I mean, is this a direct successor in sort of, you know, electoral coalition terms of UKIP and the Brexit Party? Are we seeing Reform UK essentially sort of taking on those voters who were attracted by, frankly, Nigel Farage and UKIP? Yeah. Or are we seeing anything different happening? Because it is quite interesting to look at the kind of issues that they're trying to highlight, given that they don't have this big issue of Brexit really anymore, obviously immigration being one of them. But it is quite interesting, some of the things that they're coming out with, talking about sort of the, you know, globalization or sort of, you know, trying to actually in some senses talk about sort of left behind communities and other issues that are not perhaps as associated with Brexit voters or certainly with the right of the Conservative Party, although some of them perhaps were driving some of that Brexit vote. You know, are we seeing some different appeals going on there from Reform UK to that we saw from UKIP and the Brexit Party?
So I don't think we've got to the bottom of this kind of broader question of, is this essentially a translation of the same kinds, the same people, the same kinds of people for the same kinds of reasons? So I think there were some distinctions between Brexit Party voters and UKIP voters. We did a piece, Jeff Evans and Rose DeGeus and myself, we published it in Political Studies. And one of the interesting things there, we were just comparing UKIP and Brexit Party then. I mean, this is just to your wider point of, can there, you know, essentially, has this happened before and has there been a distinction before? And there we found that it was kind of satisfaction with democracy. It was this had suddenly become more important. And that's not to say these people are wildly different. It's that there's a different set of concerns, because then it was not delivering on the Leave vote, which was a primary concern, and the, you know, huge deadlock in Parliament and the fact that Parliament couldn't pass this legislation. So it was the sort of democratic problem that was more important in 2019 for Brexit Party voters. So I'd assume that there's a slightly different bundle of issues and concerns now. And having said that, we know immigration is important to Reform UK voters. And one of the things that's interesting so far is that it's a kind of an interesting question is whether Reform is sort of, are they performing as expected? You know, like, so people are saying, oh, they're underperforming here, they're underperforming there, but the conditions are so different. And one of the interesting things is that the people that have voted Conservative in 2019, they might have voted for the Brexit Party beforehand, are more like, you know, they're splitting to Reform UK, but they're also sticking with the Tories and they're also undecided. These are the three main groups. And so, you know, you've still got this potential for Reform UK because you've got these undecided voters. Perhaps you've got the potential of taking more who currently intend to vote for the Conservative Party. But it's a kind of interesting different context, because what the biggest factor is that Nigel Farage was hugely important for the UK Independence Party. He was hugely important for the Brexit Party. Richard Tice does not get the same level of recognition. So those people who are undecided versus, I mean, I'm now paraphrasing the amazing James Griffiths, who's working on the British election study with us, just literally some emails we were kind of emailing to and fro about this. So, you know, this isn't kind of published research where we know the definitive answer. It's just stuff that we think we're finding out as we go and could be subject to change. But he was saying, you know, look, these people are more, they're less likely to have recognition of Richard Tice if they're undecided versus having a vote intentioned for reform. And I think, you know, if we think to why did UKIP and the Brexit Party do so well? Well, they had Nigel Farage. They had these really salient issues, immigration and then Brexit. And they also had European Parliament elections where they could say, we've won. Look at us. You know, aren't we on a trajectory? We've got the momentum. You know, Richard Tice doesn't have that. He doesn't have the issue agenda. He doesn't have the profile, and he doesn't have the same ability to have that profile, given those elections were, you know, actually stepping stones for the party over time. And, you know, they don't have the ground force. And also they've got a resurgent large opposition party in the Labour Party that's eating away at, you know, the vote shares in various different constituencies too, which wasn't also the case previously. So, I think it's kind of TBC. I think it's an interesting question that you raised. Just are they the same or the same kinds of people? I suspect they have a slightly different set of issue concerns, but we haven't got to the bottom of your first question yet.
They are noticeably in, I'm looking at there's a YouGov poll in the Times today, which has them on 14 points. Mm-hmm. Lib Dems are on 9. It's been one of the perhaps less prominent stories of recent times that the Lib Dems really aren't doing as well as they might be expected to do as a traditional third party and sort of repository of a lot of protest votes. Given that in the past they have benefited much more than they seem to be doing now, what do you think the reasons for that? Is it that they're sort of being squeezed as third parties traditionally are, and that the protest votes are going elsewhere? Is there anything interesting behind their position in the polls at the moment?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's so important after 2016 to think about the electorate in a realigned way. So realignments, as a, you know, sort of off the cuff definition, are moments where very different groups of people support parties. So demographics change in their relationship to the vote choice. So what we saw building up, but also very significantly after 2016, in the 2017, 2019 elections, you see the electorate essentially divide on the basis of age, educational attainment, and really representing these Brexit divides. Now, 2019, you know, why did the Conservative Party win? Well, they won because they unified the Leave vote, and they also won because the Remain vote was very divided between the Labour and Liberal Democrats and to some degree the Greens and the Nationalists. Now, I think what's important, if you think about those two sides of the electorate, is that Labour's just doing really well in that group of people the Lib Dems would also hope to attract. So essentially, it's kind of, you know, Labour are soaking up that Remain vote. And they're doing that amongst, you know, voters who might have gone to the Liberal Democrats or might have come from the Liberal Democrats. They're also doing that amongst people who are becoming less satisfied with Brexit and are actually starting to say, actually, this isn't going very well. It's not what we were promised. And, you know, actually, I think I would have changed, voted another way, or I'd vote another way again. So essentially, Labour's really squeezing the Lib Dems because you've got that kind of real, not, I don't want to say polarised because that's the wrong word, but, you know, you've got this kind of bifurcation. You've got these kind of two main sides. So I think that's one thing. And then the other, so it's very difficult for Liberal Democrats when the Labour Party is doing very well because they're both looking for the same kinds of voters. The other thing that's interesting about the Lib Dems is the Lib Dems have been doing in by-elections, you know, extremely well. And they've been doing extremely well where they're the second best place party to unseat the Conservatives. So they don't need to have a surge in their national vote share, of course. What they need to do is have highly localized, as we all know, geographically concentrated support where it really matters. And that does look, at least on the basis of by-elections so far, that they're succeeding and they're doing incredibly badly where they should do very badly. And that's exactly what they want. 2019, their vote increased, their seat numbers dropped. And it was because the inefficiency of that vote was just a lot higher. That's not to say they wouldn't be happy if they were polling better, but they, you know, what they'd be really doing is concentrating on key constituencies and hoping there to be the anti-Tory vote. And, you know, that dislike for the Conservatives is really going to be very powerful, very, very powerful set of motivations in con-Liberal Democrat contest.
Mm. And so that sort of brings us on to the effect of the election itself, where, as you say, that Lib Dems doing very well in by-elections where they're in second place suggests that at the next election, if it is effectively a referendum on the Conservatives, that this is an election which is defined by people's dislike of the Conservatives, that would suggest that the national opinion polls only give us part of the story, and that we will see that kind of either tactical voting, although I think that sort of phrase is perhaps a little bit unfair. People are voting in the way that they perceive is the best way of getting the outcome that they want. So yeah. That may suggest that perhaps the level of polling we're seeing for Reform UK and for the Lib Dems doesn't really tell the full story. We're not expecting to see huge numbers of Reform UK MPs being elected.
No.
We might expect to see an increase in the number of Lib Dems. So their relative position in the polls doesn't really tell us the full story, does it?
Yeah, and that's because that's all, as you say, it's all because of geography. So right now, looking at Reform UK doing a bit better, I start to think, okay, so you know, the estimations were, gosh, in 2019, if the Brexit Party had stood in Conservative seats, that might have made a difference of around 25 seats to the Conservative majority. What they, of course, didn't do was stand in Conservative seats because they didn't want to chip away at the Conservatives' majority. So, you know, if we've got a resurgent Reform UK and Reform UK are just sort of, you know, eating away, that means they might deprive the Conservative Party or make things harder for the Conservative Party in a general election. It doesn't mean they're going to get elected. It means that they're going to make it easier for the Labour Party to win those seats. Whereas I am expecting the Liberal Democrats to increase their number of seats. And that's precisely because of this. I mean, it's precisely because the Liberal Democrats, you know, I think by-elections are exaggerated contests in this way because so much resource and so much attention is deployed into these by-elections, which you can't possibly do in general elections. But certainly where the Liberal Democrats are in second place, you'd expect to see substantial numbers of gains. What's really difficult to know is, of course, how many. But yeah, so the polls are just telling us the national level, what really matters is the concentration and where a party can be in second place, take a first place party, win that seat. Reform UK aren't in second place. They're in third or fourth, you know, best case scenario, third place or fourth place, but they might eat away at the Conservative vote just enough to make a difference.
Mm. And looking at between now and let's say the election is going to be in the autumn, which I think Rishi Sunak has said again this week is his working assumption, which is a great phrase, given that he's the one who has to actually call it. But assuming that the election takes place towards the end of this year, there is still this this kind of belief amongst the commentariat and amongst sort of MPs that it's inevitable that when you get towards an election, the polls will tighten. This is something you hear a lot from people that yes, things are bad now, but you know, nothing will fundamentally change until we get closer to the election, either during the campaign or during the lead up to it. Is that something they can count on? I mean, historic precedents are not necessarily a guide to future performance, but that does tend to happen, and we have seen that happen in previous elections. Is there any kind of inevitability about that, or is that something which actually might not happen?
So it's only been the last two campaigns where I would say those campaigns have been really consequential. So 2017 was a narrowing campaign, and this was this was Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn, just, you know, because so much has happened, I find it quite helpful sometimes to go, oh yeah, that was the one when. Theresa May's campaign, yeah, it wasn't her finest hour. Wasn't the Conservative Party's finest hour. She, you know, she U-turned on things and obviously didn't look super comfortable. And I think, you know, Jeremy Corbyn then had essentially, you know, the Labour Party had lost a lot of its 2015 voters. They were undecided. They didn't know quite know what to make of him, which way to go. And they sort of came back in that election, and you did see a tightening. But before that, the sort of conventional wisdom in academia was that campaigns don't really change anything. And, you know, this is because there might be some sort of churn under the surface, but if you look at the aggregate outcome of that, it just tends to cancel out and tends to not really change anything. And, you know, most of the explanation before that is that, you know, the fundamentals are the things that really matter. People have made up their minds pretty much beforehand. So it's kind of a recent thing where we think the campaigns are really going to make a difference. I think the reason we might see more of a coalescing of the opinion polls, who are currently, there's very wide divergence now in what the estimated Labour lead is, anything from kind of, you know, 15 points to 27 points. The last time I sort of did the counting, which is, you know, a couple of weeks ago now. So you might see some coalescing of the opinion polls as people become more decided. I don't know, Nigel. I think, you know, there are lots of undecided voters out there still. There are lots of conservative undecided voters. And obviously what they hope is that they have a sort of 2017 kind of a campaign that Jeremy Corbyn had, that people have sort of tuned out. They come back, they look at Labour, they look at the Tories, and they go back to a conservative vote. I don't know. I really just don't know what to think about this, you know, potential campaign. Rishi Sunak, is he going to electrify the, you know, the campaign? Is he going to look super comfortable? Hasn't so far. Is Keir Starmer going to increase Labour's share even more? Because they're on a pretty high rate at the moment, given everything else that we know about how attached people are at the moment to political parties. So I don't know. We saw in 2019 both of the two largest parties increase their support, and that's also been interesting. Like, the two party share has been high the last two elections. You know, are the smaller parties going to start eating into that vote on both sides? You know, the Reform and the Lib Dems and Greens and so on. But yeah, like I say, it used to be pretty normal to say campaigns don't make a jot of difference.
Yes, it's almost like a sort of make work scheme for hard-pressed political journalists when you have a narrative that seems so glaringly obvious to try and inject some drama into the campaign. If you say, oh, well, the polls are tightening, it kind of gives you a sense that things might not be going the way that they look on the face of it to be heading. And when you've got a Labour lead of sort of around the 20-point mark, you say anything between 15 and 27, you know, it doesn't take a huge amount of political analysis to say that it doesn't look good for the Conservatives and it looks very good for Labour. So I think there might be a bit of that going on, that people want to inject a bit more drama into it. But is there a factor, there's another sort of thing you sometimes hear touted, that maybe as an explanation as well for that turnaround in 2017, that because the Conservatives started that campaign as the sort of absolute out-and-out favourites, kind of, again, 20 points ahead of Labour in the polls, that there was a suggestion that it almost made it safe for Labour voters to go back to Jeremy Corbyn, even if they were not terribly happy with him, because it didn't look like he was going to win. And that sort of conversely, there is that idea that if the outcome looks obvious, you almost give permission to people to sort of go back against it slightly. Is that something that, well, firstly, is that something that did play into 2017 from the evidence that we have? And secondly, is that something that perhaps we should be looking to factor in to the potential result of the next election if we go into the next election campaign with Labour still at these kind of dizzying heights and being so far ahead of the Conservatives, that might actually, in some ways, with the sort of the underdog syndrome, help the Conservatives perhaps to hang on to some of those voters or to attract some of them back, because those who don't want them in office but perhaps aren't that keen on Labour might see it as a safe thing to do?
So I think the major caveat to all of this is that, you know, we bring to bear all kinds of things when we think about who's going to win the election, right? So one is our priors and our preferences. So, you know, there were lots of people. I remember looking at British election study data, and I think it was Chris Prosser and I were looking at this, and, you know, there were lots of, certainly considerable numbers of UKIP voters who were saying, yeah, UKIP's going to win the election. You know, I mean, this is not going to happen, right? So, and it's not to say that those people are stupid in any way. It's that when people are answering survey questions, maybe they're just sort of thinking about those questions slightly differently. I think the other thing is, and it does frustrate me, I've got to be honest, that our political leaders will undermine the opinion polls all the way through the election because they have an incentive to do so. So they are saying, ignore these polls, ignore these polls. It doesn't mean anything, blah, 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 blah. You know, Labour's not taking anything for granted. The only election, you know, the only poll that matters is the one on election day. The Conservatives will be saying the same thing. And they'll even be, you know, essentially rubbishing some very good, so, you know, research that's being done that's cumulative and actually very telling. So that's a shame. That's a shame that that happens. So, you know, does everybody go into the election very, very certain about who's going to win in a sort of objective way? Well, that's the first thing, is no. The second thing I think, so I don't think I've seen anything that's really convinced me that that narrative about 2017 was true. I also think what really is going to be more kind of well evidenced is that when people think an election is a foregone conclusion, they're just more likely to sit it out.
Right.
So if, you know, if you, like 2001, was one of these elections. Labour just won the landslide in 1997. They were way ahead in the polls. The Conservative Party was still figuring out how to respond to defeat, really, under William Hague. Turnout dropped significantly. So that's the foregone conclusion problem is a very sort of, you know, really points to a low turnout election. The other thing that points to a low turnout election is not really being able to see clear differences between the two major parties. They're not offering very much that's different in terms of spending. In fact, Labour are trying so hard to stick to Conservative spending commitments. So I'd more point in that direction of it being a sort of turnout problem for the next election. Now, the one thing I should say is that whilst the opinion polls differ on the Labour lead, that's hugely consequential for the seat gains and whether it's a Labour majority squeak over the line for a narrow Labour majority just on a sort of 12 point something swing, which is huge, or whether it's a Labour safe majority or even a Labour landslide. So the size of that gap is hugely significant, actually, for the actual outcome. So there's an awful lot that we don't yet know. And that's partly because that range is so big. Currently, we don't know if we're at the bottom of it or at the top of it.
Yes. And I think part of the sort of problem with looking at the kind of numbers we're seeing at the moment is, we haven't seen, I mean, if we look at a sort of 27 point lead for Labour, or, you know, the Conservatives sort of barely scraping 20 points in some polls, we haven't seen an outcome like that in living memory of the Conservatives going down to whatever that would equate to, sort of 80 seats or less. So I think that's possibly, you know, just because we don't think that it could conceivably happen, people tend to sort of like look at the numbers and think, well, that can't be right. It must change. And there was a bit of that, wasn't there, in 2017, where we had that sort of, at the time, experimental poll. Was it MRP? What's the Times poll, the Times YouGov experimental poll that they did with the sort of the larger sample in different key seats?
I think you're talking about an MRP.
Yes. So that was done during 2017. And it showed the Conservatives losing their majority and Labour doing much better than had been anticipated, and the a bit like you were saying, that parties do during the course of a campaign. It was rubbished by not just the parties, but by the coverage of that poll itself. It was just sort of almost at the bottom of the bottom of the paper, and they sort of said, "Oh, well, this is an interesting sort of sidebar. It can't possibly happen." There is something in the fact that people sort of don't want to believe the numbers in front of them if they don't accord with their belief what's going to happen. So, you know, looking at the numbers we're seeing now, I mean, it's perfectly possible that the Conservatives could go down to an historically bad defeat that sort of is completely unprecedented, isn't it?
So I think your wider point is bang on, that, you know, we need to be really, really careful about following the crowd on the narrative around elections and allowing the uncertainty. I mean, I remember in 2015, this was when I learned my lesson on this, right? So I remember going, so 2015 was the year where there was a polling miss. And, you know, obviously the Conservatives won and Labour were predicted to win. And, you know, I remember just saying, well, everybody's aligning. So therefore, you know, we can have greater confidence. And the problem was everybody was aligning on data that was aligned incorrectly. So it's really, I mean, it's kind of the fine line between informed caution and rubbishing skepticism. We need informed caution, not, oh, everything's rubbish or all polls are junk or we can't trust anything. I mean, that's nonsense, right? So it's informed caution. I think, and I think the other really interesting example of this came in the referendum, the EU referendum, which was actually an example where the polls were doing fine. There was a trend increased over the campaign. Leave were doing better. All the polls were picking that up. And there were as many polls that suggested Leave were ahead as suggested Remain were ahead. You'd never, ever have known that the week before the referendum, when nobody could, you know, well, the majority of commentators just couldn't accept that this was going to happen. And that was a really, and that's often thrown back and said, well, you know, didn't the polls get it wrong in the EU referendum? It's like, no, it was the commentary. It was the commentariat that got it wrong. So going into the next election, yes, it's possible that this is going to be, you know, the nadir for the Conservative Party. How does that happen? Well, it happens because, you know, it's a Labour SNP race in Scotland. It happens because Reform UK are eating away and making Labour's life easier. Actually, not in some of the Red Wall seats, because I think they're one for the Labour Party, frankly, now, but in some other seats, perhaps. And that depends on if Reform UK can, you know, build up. And it happens because there's a Liberal Democrat resurgence as well, and they're taking seats away from the Conservatives. I think where it's, you know, where you've got to be a bit careful as well on this, though, is that currently there are MRP models. So these are modeling. These are taking large samples of opinion polls and also using local area data to make predictions about seat gains or losses. So there are some pretty wild ones out there, you know, and we think it's still a huge task. You know, we're talking about a huge swing for Labour just to have a majority of two, over 12%. You know, so there's a huge task. So I think, you know, we've got to remember that. The other thing about that YouGov MRP is that YouGov did that very late on. It was a couple of days before the outcome. And at that point, it probably is easier to pick up the tendency that voters are leaning towards in the tactical vote, the distribution of the votes, that all that all important geography that we were talking about. It's probably a lot easier. So I'm going to be looking at everything, but if there's an MRP that comes out a day or two before, I'm going to trust that probably quite a lot more than one that came a month before. And then the other thing is that people are building all sorts of assumptions into their MRP models. And, you know, you've got to weigh up, you know, well, okay, which of those seem sensible? Anyway, so there's lots around this, I think, and I'm really waffling. But I think, you know, the sort of don't throw the baby out with bathwater, but have a healthy dose of kind of, you know, think for yourself is probably where I fall down.
And you touched there on the sort of cyclical skepticism about polls, because, as you say, 2015 there was a miss, but I mean it is fair to say that, you know, closer to polling day. As you say, the 2017 MRP was closer to polling day. But in recent years, the exit poll has been absolutely sort of gold standard, hasn't it? We've come to trust the exit poll as being sort of almost you know, exactly right in recent elections.
It's a completely different exercise.
Yeah, well, quite a bit, but in the past, that wasn't the case either, was it? I think was it 92 the opinion poll was that the exit poll was out, and that hasn't been the case recently. So you know, as you get closer towards poll, it is becoming much easier to sort of see what's about to happen. But on the general issue of trust in polls, where do you think the industry and polls are at the moment in terms of their level of trustworthiness, both in terms of how good do you think the modelling is objectively now, and how do you think the standing of them is amongst both the public and the commentariat, do you think?
I don't really know if I know the answer to that. I think there's some really interesting changes. So it's becoming cheaper to run opinion polls. And there's been a growth in the number of people that are polling. So that's that's interesting. I think, you know, on the data science side, there are huge, huge leaps and strides in sort of people's technical proficiency. You know, the number of people now with data science skills going into opinion polling agencies and applying themselves to, you know, to kind of state of the art, cutting edge, you know, methods of weighting or whatever is improving. And then of course, you know, we learn with every election in terms of opinion polls about elections. Obviously there are opinion polls about all sorts of things. But if we're talking about political polling, you know, then I think the industry was hugely responsive to the inquiry that took place in 2015 in terms of learning from that. Whether or not that has improved or dented the trustworthiness of opinion pollsters, I suspect if I really thought about it, there's probably been a bit of a loss of trust because there's been a lot of trust all over the place. And these kinds of broad sweeping statements, oh, well, the polls didn't get this right and they didn't get that right and they didn't get this right, you know, that narrative has, I think, taken hold, and it's not fair. It's not, you know, it's partly fair that 2015 was a miss, but it's not fair that everything's been terrible in the polling industry and they missed everything, you know. So, and part of that, I think, has been because we've had hugely, hugely weird times. You know, so we put all of that bucket of things together and we think like, oh my gosh, politics has been so unpredictable. We didn't think we were going to have a coalition. We didn't think we were going to have a Tory majority in 2015. We didn't think we were going to have, you know, a loss of the majority in 2017. We didn't think Boris Johnson was going to win. You know, to say then, because politics has been tumultuous, the polling industry hasn't performed well, I think would be entirely wrong, actually. But I'd imagine that in the bucket of ways that many people think about politics, it's just, oh, it's all been crazy and unpredictable and we didn't expect any of these things. And, you know, someone should have told us that these things were going to happen. And I think, you know, the other thing that we as a British Election Study team have been focused on in our, we put out, you know, we wrote a book about it, was electoral volatility. And I think that, you know, that whole kind of acceptance that we're in a more volatile era has made people feel that things are sort of more or less predictable and less sure and less certain. But there's no evidence that the polling industry isn't picking up that volatility or isn't picking up that likelihood of, you know, different elections that we weren't expecting. I think we, you know, the point you raised earlier about the difference between what the polls are showing and what people can accept to be true and plausible is probably where there's some work to do. The other thing that I think has been a really positive change is I think there has been a greater knowledge and awareness in many reputable media organizations about how to report polls. And how to talk about data. So it's still annoying when people go, there's a two-point change. The Conservatives have got to bounce, and it's just random error. It's just noise. That's still annoying, but there are fewer. I think the reputable media organisations have done a lot, and I think there's been a lot of training. And certainly the British Polling Council has been, you know, involved in providing some of that training and some of that resource, and I think that's been a good thing. And that's something that really needs to continue.
Mm. And just sort of perhaps to end on that volatility point, I suppose it's true to say if the polls have been all over the place, it's because the voters have been all over the place as well,
right.
In recent years. And as you say, events as well, that old chestnut about sort of events in politics, we've had a lot of events as well in the last decade. But if we fast forward to what looks to be the outcome of the next election at this point, of Labour winning by whatever margin that turns out to be, the focus of my work in this podcast is on opposition. If we see the Conservatives going into opposition on the back of a historically bad defeat, the conventional wisdom would be, oh, you don't come back from that in one term. That you're sort of destined to sort of bump along the bottom for quite a long time. The government, a new government, will get a honeymoon, and so on. We've seen that pattern sort of happen before, and I just wonder whether perhaps the only comfort for Conservatives sort of looking over the cliff edge might be that this greater volatility that we're seeing maybe means that need not be true. Mm. That perhaps you know, there are examples, you know, of the polls turning around, particularly given the fact that if we look at the start of Keir Starmer's time as leader of the opposition, conventional wisdom was, well, he wasn't going to come back in one term, mm-hmm. because they just had an historically bad election defeat. I think we do forget that. And you made the point about the sort of swing that's required. That swing is important because of how historically bad Labour's result was last time. So, you know, it can happen, and we're seeing that happen now, that things can turn around pretty dramatically. Do you think that increased volatility that we're seeing perhaps does suggest that we could see a historically bad defeat for the Conservatives, but it need not perhaps be the situation we've had in the past where that then remains sort of irrecoverable for a long time?
Yeah, I know is the answer, I think. Mm. I think the volatility point is kind of separate. So over the very long term, we're seeing a gradual increase in volatility. We're also seeing decreases in certain election periods. Volatility actually went down a little bit in 2017, but it was still quite high. So switching of vote choice between two election pairs. It went down again in 2019. And now that doesn't mean to say that over the very long term that we're not on this sort of gradual trend towards more switching, because we're getting less attached to parties. Younger people are coming into the electorate who are less attached to parties, as their parents might have been, and so on. So generational change will probably move in that direction, unless there's something dramatic that attaches new cohorts of the electorate to parties. But there are election pairs where there's much less switching. And so I don't think this is a sort of blanket, everything's more unpredictable, everything's more volatile, it's always going to be more, you know. I think it's a kind of get out of jail card that's being used too loosely in politics. I think it's being sort of bandied around. You're like, oh, well, anything can happen. Everything's become more volatile. No, I think what we've seen since 2019 is the Labour Party get in shape and get its act together and look pretty much like a unified team. Of course, they've had difficulties over anti-Semitism and over Gaza. But they got their house in order pretty quickly, actually, after 2019. And they've also pretty much hogged the middle ground on economics. They've really protected their reputation for economic competence. And they have also got this larger coalition of sort of Remainy, younger, higher educated group of voters that they've grown. And they've grown that for some interesting reasons, as we've talked about. So, you know, and the flip side of that is the Conservatives really have, I mean, they really have had some disasters, you know. So is it kind of normal for a party to come back so quickly from a historically bad defeat as Labour had in 2019? Well, no. And I think, you know, Labour had done a lot of work over a long time period and a lot of soul searching first, you know, with Jeremy Corbyn and all of that. They really had learned some lessons. Now, the question is, will the Conservatives, if they go into opposition after being in power for so long, will they have done that work? Will they have worked out how to restore their reputation for competence? Will they work out how to respond to the electoral map and rebuild their coalition? And will they benefit from an incumbent government that, frankly, shoots itself in the foot a few times? And we don't know. But, you know, what we're seeing in certainly from the outside looking in, I'm certainly only able to think about it that way. From the outside looking in, the Conservatives look like they're already having a fight about why Boris won in 2019, why if only Rishi had been Boris, and if only we'd gone harder on Rwanda and all the rest of it. They look like they're lurching to the right. And I don't think they're going to win elections that way. So we'll see. We'll see how they respond.
Well, no doubt we'll come back and discuss that if and when that occurs. But just very quickly, what are you most looking forward to? Presumably you're looking forward to quite a busy election campaign and an election night. Where are you going to be for election night and what are you looking forward to?
So I'm going to be in the ITV studio again, and I'm looking forward to that. What am I most looking forward to? I think it's just a bumpy year. I think it's, you know, it's US and UK for me are, you know, the two elections that I'm most closely followed over recent years. And I feel so invested in it now because I've been doing this over some time now. I feel kind of intellectually invested in these election outcomes because I've been thinking about certainly the UK very closely and the US in a comparative sense. And absolutely fascinating. So these, you know, for the US, huge stakes, massively important, you know, absolutely fascinating. So I guess it's just the honour and the privilege of having a bit of a front row seat and having a chance to understand it in real time is the kind of the most exciting part for me, I think.
Fantastic. Well, thanks very much indeed for joining us again. And as I say, we're in for a bumpy ride, whatever happens. So I'm sure we'll speak again.
Thank you.
Jane, thanks very much indeed.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Jane Green there giving some fascinating analysis and her thoughts on current political polling in the UK and what might be behind those numbers. It was great to have such a long discussion with her to really dig into some of these issues in more detail. One thing that she did say that might perhaps be of some comfort to the Prime Minister and his allies at this difficult time is that it doesn't look likely that yet another change of leader will do very much to change the fundamental position that the Conservative Party finds itself in. So if there are MPs considering getting out their, I'm sure by now, pro forma letters of no confidence to the chairman of the 1922 committee, they might want to think twice before photocopying those and changing the name at the top. But of course, if you do want to hear all about the 1922 committee and its influence, you can go back and listen to our last episode with Philip Norton on that very subject. Before I go, I think it's also worth mentioning that whatever happens in the UK and US elections later this year, they will at least be conducted freely and fairly, with voters given a proper democratic choice of who should lead the country. And that can't, of course, be said for some of this year's other elections. Most notably, this week, voters are heading to the polls in Russia today and over the weekend to vote in their country's presidential election. And I don't think we need to draw on much polling analysis to work out that Vladimir Putin will be the winner, given that he's ensured that any credible opposition figure that he might have faced has either been banned from standing, imprisoned, or in the case of Alexei Navalny that we've just seen, and others in previous years, murdered by the Russian state. It really is a depressing state of affairs, and we plan to return to the subject of Russia and opposition to Putin in a future episode. The sham election that we're seeing today is a reminder once again of how precious political freedoms are and how vital it is that democratic opposition should not just be tolerated, but actually celebrated as an integral part of a free society. But for the moment, that's all for this episode. I'll be back with you again soon, so do make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts from. Give us a positive review or rating, and do spread the word by reposting this episode and any others that you find interesting on social media so that others can find us. Until next time, thanks for listening, look after yourselves, and I'll see you again soon. You've been listening to Opposition Cast from the Centre for Opposition Studies, presented by me, Nigel Fletcher. Our theme music is by Tom Hector, and you can find us on Twitter at OppositionUK and online at oppositionstudies.net.
If I were smart, I'd go home now.